Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to the A-List with me, Jennifer Lindsay. Every week we chat with an influencer to see what makes them tick. And today, on Friday, February 19th, 2010, I am delighted to welcome our featured guest, Kara Swisher, from All Things D. And Kara, are you on the line?
Yes, I am.
Welcome. Thank you for being on the show.
No problem.
Must be very busy.
Yeah, today is a busy day indeed.
So I said the anecdote of kind of what made me think, oh my gosh, we have to have you on the program, was when I was at the web conference in December.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, it's a conference about the web, and you're thinking, okay, you're getting all of the latest stuff, and there were so many announcements. Came back to my hotel after the first night of a two-day conference, and I switch on BBC or CNN World News, and there you are talking about the AOL Time merger split, and I thought, my God, this is such huge news. Why isn't anyone talking about this? So I thought that that would be a good segue into kind of talking about what I think a lot of people know you for, which has been your excellent reporting in two books on AOL, Time Warner, and really I'd love to hear, I'm a fellow Columbia J School alum, kind of the journey of how you got kind of on that beat or, you know, really delved as deeply as you have in that area.
Well, just that particular company. I write about all the companies. I mean, I write a lot about Yahoo, obviously, and Microsoft and Google. I wrote some of the first early stories about Google in the Wall Street Journal, for example. And, excuse me, I'm going to cough. Anyway, I have a little cold. So I originally went to Georgetown University in Washington, D.C., and I was going to go into the Foreign Service, and I got interested in journalism and ended up working through a series of kind of different things that happened at the Washington Post. I did freelancing for them from Georgetown. I went to Columbia for journalism school, which is pretty much a waste of time, I thought.
Yeah, me
but,
too.
you know, I wish I had that money back. And then I'd been talking to newspapers all around the country, and I decided to go back to the Washington Post in a lesser position, and because I didn't want to move to, essentially to Florida, to a small town in Florida. So I went to the Washington Post, and I worked my way up, and finally got on the business beat, and I covered a lot of different things. I covered retail, a whole bunch of stuff, and eventually I ended up covering, at the time the business beat was a backwater. I was very interested in business as an area. And it was just starting to explode after Barbarians at the Gate. It started to become something that was somewhat respectable. And so I started covering a small company called AOL, and it was very small at the time, a couple hundred people, I think. And so I was very much there at the beginning of this digital age, which was much more, it was sort of a crude version of what's happening now. And I started covering AOL, and they were at the nexus of so many different companies and so many different trends. And it was in Washington, D.C., in the same area I was in, so I was sort of the beat reporter in the town the company was founded in. And so it went from there, and I was very interested in AOL and ended up writing a book about it. I thought it was going to get big, and it turned out while I was writing it, they had their famous outage, and all kinds of things happened to them that it was very clear that they were sort of the cutting edge of what was happening. And then I wrote a book by Matt Walmsberg, who was the tech reviewer for the Wall Street Journal, because he was one of the very early proponents of these online services, especially AOL. And we became good friends, and he urged me to work at the Journal because they covered the Internet like it was CB radio, and he and I felt it was a much more important trend. So I ended up being the Internet reporter at the Journal in San Francisco eventually when I came out of my book leave and left the Washington Post to go there. And again, you know, Yahoo had not, I don't believe they'd gone public. Most of these companies had not gone public or were even in existence. And so I was there sort of early again to the second phase of the Internet growth, which was Amazon and Yahoo. And then for the third, which was Google. And, you know, it just kept building on itself. So it's sort of like covering something from the very beginning. So I got to know all the players pretty well.
Interesting, because a lot of people don't realize that, you know, that AOL was in, or I don't know if it still is, in the D.C. area, and so, you know, that was a big part of things.
Yeah, they still do, yeah. They still have presence there.
And I remember I was at a failed startup during the .com, .boom here
first
in San Francisco,
yeah,
the
Web
first one, the 1.0, and ended up my the person that led the company went to AOL in the DC area, and we were like, wow, you know, we didn't know it was there.
Yeah.
So it's really interesting. One thing I think that is kind of interesting from a reporting aspect is you mentioned this a couple of times, is or kind of alluded to it. I shouldn't speak for you. You were at places where it could have been considered not really what we do. We don't really go that, you know, that's pushing the envelope of what we do. What were some significant, you know, either breaks or, you know, opportunities that came your way that made you, you know, be able to pursue it? Or just, you know, did you just decide this is legitimate journalism?
No, I just, you know, they were interested in me moving to a political beat at the Washington Post, which at the time was considered a big deal because I'd done really well on the business beat. But I wasn't interested even slightly in politics, which is a big deal at the Washington Post. You know, cover the White House, like the top of the top. Which
Yeah, absolutely.
I just thought it was dull and horrible. And I was very much interested in the transformative impact of the Internet. I really, you know, it's sort of like seeing Hollywood at the beginning or when you saw talkies for the first time. And I thought this was going to be... You know, I remember using a Mosaic browser very early, and the ability to access any information anywhere was really powerful as far as I was concerned. And so I got super interested in the technology being as transformative as television or anything like that. And I think that was – I just sort of recognized this was going to be a big deal. And when most people were treating it like it was CB radio, like it was a fad, like it was going to go away. Because, you know, again, when I got to the Journal, the big beat was media. You know, all these media companies are in full retreat right now, but at the time, that was it, you know, the big, and I wasn't interested in them because they were the past, and I always felt that everything was going online, especially journalism, and so I, again, got out of print journalism, a couple of years ago, because I saw that this was not going to last with this Internet phenomena, and so I just think it's just sort of recognizing where things are going and being willing to change with them is, you know, the key part of doing that. And actually having a huge interest in it, obviously, is the most important thing. I have a big interest in online. So since it's interesting to me, I make it interesting to readers. That's the hope, at least.
Yeah, you do. You do a great job. Obviously, you're a very well-respected writer. I'm really curious about your 2003 sequel, it's called in your bio. There must be a pony in here somewhere, the AOL Time Warner debacle and the quest for a digital future, which I guess by reading it in hindsight could have predicted the split of the two companies. You want to talk at all about what, you know, kind of when you started working on the book and when you kind of felt like it was time to revisit?
Well, I was working on the first one. I think I was very early to this idea. I sort of was writing about AOL before they became as important, and people forget how important AOL. AOL was the Google of its day, you know, kind of so powerful. Everyone thought it couldn't be, impacted. They thought it would run everything. So, I mean, that gives you an idea of what could happen to anyone.
Yeah, I mean, everybody had an AOL.com email address.
It was the company, and obviously it had a lot of vulnerabilities. So the first book was about the rise of this, and I used AOL as the phenomenon, I didn't think that necessarily AOL was going to be that company, but it certainly represented the phenomena of this online trend that was going upwards. And the second one, all I knew was it's going up, you know, this is going to get bigger and bigger and more prevalent. And then the second book was about the downturn. Obviously, when the AOL Time Warner merger happened, everyone was touting it as the greatest thing ever. It was sort of the peak of the dot-com boom, that particular dot-com boom. And so I was, lucky enough to be having written the only book on AOL at the time. So everyone was like, if they wanted to know about this little upstart that bought the biggest media company in the world, they had to read for me who these people were, which was a great position to be in. And then when the merger happened, it almost immediately... you know, sort of crack the whole facade of what was going on there apart, and sort of the not ready for prime time-ness of AOL. And so it was great to write about the down. You know, I didn't care if it went up or down. It's just a story. I mean, to me, it's a story. So it was, you know, it was perfect to see these two cultures clash, to see these two, traditional media and new media clash. There's all kinds of interesting dynamics among people and trends and everything. So it was a good book to do. The second one, I happened to be, I happened to have been on maternity leave, so it was a perfect time to, when the merger, after the merger, I was on maternity leave in 2002, when it really started to decline, that merger. And so I was able to take some time off after I had my baby to work on the second book. And it just got worse and worse, which made it better and better for my book. Steve Case once told me, he goes, "You don't care how this turns out." I go, nope, I don't. I don't care. That's your job. I'm just telling the story. So I started writing the book pretty much in real time to when it was happening, and then got it out. There were several books at that time competing. There weren't any when I was doing the first book. And I just felt like it was a good bookend, you know, each and then the rise and fall, essentially, of this iconic company. I took some time off from the journal. And when I came back, my partner had gotten a job at Google, which I had covered, and I couldn't cover it anymore. And I felt Google was going to be the big company, obviously, for the next year. And so there was an inadequate way to do disclosure on a print. I didn't want to really work for print anyway anymore. But I wanted to long do a blog for the journal, and we ended up first doing a conference that was pretty well known, our D, All Things Digital conference. And
oh,
then the
yeah,
blog
that spells out incredibly
yeah.
quick.
it got pretty, we're a very successful conference, and then we did the blog afterwards. Walt and I did that together.
Which is great coverage.
Yeah, so we consider it one big brand, the conference, the blog. We have plans for other stuff, but, the idea was that we were creating this entirely new journalistic institution that is all online or has other revenue streams like the conference, and at the same time maintains the quality and the integrity and the ethics of, you know, the Wall Street Journals of the world.
It's really, really inspiring to hear that you never really felt like a digital feeling, you know,
right,
where people just weren't getting it. I mean, I know a couple of times in my career I've hit that point where been like, nobody quite gets what I do, and I need to move on professionally to something. And that was one of the reasons I actually went to Columbia after 7 years in new media. And so I followed your columns with great interest. And one I want to talk about a little bit because it was one that I followed, which is Boomtown.
Yeah.
And
no, it's still called the Boomtown Call. I had it first in the journal, and then it was in a print publication, and then I did it, moved it online only.
And
so
you started it in San Francisco, I believe, right?
Yes, yeah, in the early 2000s, I'm thinking 98, 99, 99 maybe, something like that, yeah.
And the thing that was to me so interesting is that you've kind of had a career in multiple places and on both coasts, which is, you know, a very unique place.
Well, there's only two of them, so yeah.
Okay, so are you in the D.C. area now?
I was. No, I live in San Francisco. I don't live in
okay.
D.C. No, I,
but,
wor-
but,
I worked in, I went to Columbia, obviously, which is in New York, and then I moved to D.C., so I worked at the Washington Post, and then I moved to the Wall Street, to work at the Wall Street Journal. I was their internet reporter about the internet. You know, I covered Amazon and all the, you know, the IPOs at the time.
Uh-huh.
So I, you know, and then I decided I didn't want to work for a newspaper anymore. I wanted to try this thing on our own, which is how we got to what we're doing now.
Which is great. And I think that one of the things that's interesting to me is kind of, well, Stowe Boyd was on the show a few weeks ago, and something he said keeps sticking with me, which is, he moved recently to New York City in the East Coast. He's, I think, splitting time in Virginia, and he said that, you know, he really felt like he wanted to go to New York because there's a lot of innovation happening there, and here innovation is in the San Francisco area is happening under the cloud of failure, and so it's a different kind of innovation. And at first I thought,
what do you mean? I think this is pretty successful companies, and New York doesn't have hardly any innovation in comparison.
Well, what we kind of ended up talking about, and this is the way that I sort of contextualized it. So we were talking about trends, especially for, you know, kind of, you know, him positioning himself as a futurist. You know, things like Foursquare and Gowalla are in Austin and New York City. Mobile's kind of up for grabs as to where the home will be.
Well, I don't think there's a geographical anything for anything. I mean, Foursquare is very nice, but it's a game, and I think you'll probably not hear from it in 5 years, would be my guess. I mean, there's been a million Foursquares. So if you're talking about profound, important companies, they're all, I don't think they're anywhere necessarily, but, I mean, the key companies right now and going forward in mobile are Apple, Google, and presumably Microsoft if it gets its act together, so that's up in Seattle. So, you know, I don't think that, I mean, you're talking about companies that interest the blogosphere, like Foursquare mm-hmm. and Gowalla. It doesn't interest the mass. I'm interested in the mass market. I'm not interested in things that amuse, you know, 26 white guys in you know, Silicon Valley or New York City. I'm interested in what has mass consumer impact. What happens in the Silicon Valley mentality or the sort of geek blogosphere is they get all fixated on some trendy little topic that I could name you hundreds of companies that were going to be the most important companies that you've never heard of again. There's been 90 Gowallas, by the way. There's been 90 Foursquares. And, you know, and Facebook, that's the other one. Facebook's the other significant company, again, in Palo Alto, California. But, I mean, you have to think about what has the mass consumer appeal. I mean, what's something that's really going to be profoundly impact consumer behavior across the world. And none of these tiny little companies at this moment in time are. But, I mean, the significant companies remain in Silicon Valley, and they remain Apple, Google, Microsoft, Facebook to a large extent now. And that's, you know, you've pretty much sewn up what the most important companies are. And then you think about the second tier. I mean, obviously Amazon's a very important company in e-commerce. And, you know, but, you know, I'm not interested in the trendy things. I'm interested in the things that are going to have, again, mass consumer appeal.
Mm-hmm. So how much does social media factor into kind of your gut instinct about what will or will not catch on?
Well, I think social media, it's like saying, you know, the problem is people, you know, they love to create these catchphrases of everything. Again,
unfortunately,
I'm so old, I've seen it before, so I don't, you know, these people go, oh, all of a sudden it's this or all of a sudden it's that, because that's the kind of, you know, juvenile mentality, which is great for technology, but at the same time that has no memory or any kind of thing. And so many of the, I mean, if you think about it, AOL had, you know, groups, it had connections, it had the chat, it was Facebook of its day, you know what I mean? Like,
mm-hmm.
So it's not that anyone's inventing anything new under the sun. And in social media, I think everything does become socialized because these tools allow you to have much more socialization. But social in itself, in and of itself, is not significant. It's how you take these tools and let people use them. And, you know, it's sort of like the telephone isn't significant as a device. It's significant because you can talk to people, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And I think people in technology get interested in the device. Like the iPad or the tablet is significant because of what it will allow you to do with the media on it. It's not
mm-hmm.
significant as a device. It's just, you know, another tool to be able to do things. And so, you know, I mean, we've always been socialized. It's not websites we look at. It's websites we participate and can contribute and change and move, which is important. But to me, you'd have to think of the significant trends. One is screens everywhere. I'm very interested in screens everywhere, that walls become screens, that tables become screens. The second thing that's critically important is power consumption, is how do you create devices that you just put down on a table and they interact with each other and they trade information without you having to push buttons and everything like that. The other trend that's critically important is touch screens, everything being touch screens. That's something that is a mass idea where you don't have like any little input device the way you do now.
Mm-hmm.
And the fourth one is which has to do with social, is how do you communicate this vast amount of information with not with keywords. You know what I mean? There was the contextual, like, I am looking for a camera. I want a camera. So I want to get stuff that comes from, you know, experts. I want to get stuff that's user-generated. Is that social? Yeah, sure, whatever. But and then I want to be able to have stuff that is relevant to me or people like me. And so I'm interested in all these things. I think sticking a social, label on something is just to get VCs to give you money. But everything is going to be social. Everything is social. And our society already was social to start with. This just gives you technology tools to continue to be the way humans already are with each other.
I mean, so how much do you think that this sort of emphasis and even this blog chat that you're talking about, where there's this sort of broad within certain blogs of particular kinds of technology that there's a fixation on for whatever reason. How much do you think that affects sort of global funding and people that are out there with the next best idea, but they happen to be in Paris?
Well, I don't think it matters where you are now. That's one great thing about a lot of this ability to communicate across global. You know, there's no geography, which is, I think, a great thing. But I don't, you know, again, I think people get caught up in the latest trend versus the, you know, all that matters. It doesn't matter if I cover it or any other of these sites covered it. You know, the navel gazing gets ridiculous. What's important are the products that are created, and people lose sight of the products. And that's what's most important, is people creating, no matter where you are, creating these fascinating little products, like the apps, the trend of towards apps on the iPhone. Now, who could have predicted that 2 years ago? Nobody. Mm-hmm. To whatever, or the ability to, you know, Google Goggles, for example, I think is really interesting, taking pictures of things and then it's searching based on mm-hmm. visual images. Some of the things Microsoft is doing in mapping, you know what I mean? Like these what they're doing is building on tools that already exist to create a much more interactive and immersive experience, and I think mm-hmm. that doesn't have any borders. I mean, I don't think it has borders, but what you have to be interested in is the products, not about... You know, we get so caught up in the little stupid personalities and the fundings and stuff like that. But what's important is to me, if you create a great product, it doesn't matter where you are, because really good funders will find you now, as opposed to 10 years ago when it would stick just in Silicon Valley or parts of New York or Austin. Now you can be almost anywhere to be able to create, you know, all kinds of cool features and products and technology things that you can sell to people.
The screens everywhere... sort of, I don't, if you would consider that sort of key area that you're looking at, or...
I'm focused on it almost, I'm fascinated with the idea of mobility of information, and I don't mean just a small handheld device. I mean mobility of information. You know, if you think about the Minority Report, the guy who designed all that stuff, where he was moving around stuff on a screen with his hands. I mean, I think it has to go hand in hand with touch screen, with movement, with screens that respond to you and in a spatial way, where you can be, you know, I guess in Minority Report, that movie Tom Cruise was in, where he walks into the Gap and it said, oh, you just bought a fleece, would you like this? It knew who he was. That kind of stuff is, to me, going to be information that moves with you, and you move with the information, and you have information attached to you so that they know who you are. I think that, to me, is really interesting, where you don't repeat... The information moves around you versus you going out and getting it and collecting it and bringing it back. I think it's a very profound idea.
Absolutely.
Entertainment, commerce, health, you could just go through everything in that regard.
Question, though, you know, one thing to think about making things more contextual and more you-focused is, some people say, how much have you reported or explored that as part of your work? Because it
privacy.
Seems to go kind of hand in hand. Yeah.
Privacy. I mean, look at what happened with Google Buzz this past week. It's a mess. It's a disaster. They didn't think it out. They didn't think it out. I'm sure it will pass, as all these things do. But, you know, Facebook every 3 months seems to step right in and again with the safety. People don't have a memory of this stuff very much, and so they keep giving up pieces of their privacy, and then they forget they're angry, and then the next thing becomes worse and worse. I think ultimately probably privacy issues are hugely important, but it seems like people are willing to give them up in order to get something else. So on Facebook, you give up quite a bit of your privacy, but you get to make these connections. And I think more and more, especially young people, they don't mind giving up all kinds of information about themselves. You know, these are things we'll sort out when the first big disaster, privacy disaster happens. But it's usually small little things like credit cards get stolen or identities get stolen.
Mm-hmm.
But we still haven't faced sort of the apocalypse of privacy problems yet, you know, on some level.
Yeah, I kind of feel like that's a building thing, you know. Like
it could be, you know, you could get a fascist government taking over, I don't know, Canada or something like that. You know, I mean, that's where it would be very frightening, the kind of levels of information and scrutiny that even, you know, that a Google has on you. You know, they know your search trail. Now, right now, perhaps it's not being run by evil people, but maybe someday it will be. So, I mean, I think it doesn't matter whether it's Google or any of these things, is that the ability to access vast amounts of information about individuals is just growing in a quantum way. And so, I don't know who the government, I don't think the government even understands what a lot of these companies do. So I'm not sure who steps in to protect people in this regard, because it's so incomprehensible and vast and out there. But there's people like the FCC is trying to do things. There's a lot of watchdog groups, but it's sort of one of these increasingly insurmountable problems that I suspect there'll be some sort of crazy privacy incident at some point.
I also think there's this interesting interplay with consumer products and B2B products that maybe have a consumer arm. So what I mean by that is, I remember going into a doctor's appointment a year ago, and the doctor had basically an iPad, but, you know, obviously from a different company, with all my electronic medical records, and, you know, been lucky to live in the Bay Area for a while. So I just switched doctors. That doctor has everything from years back and could and actually identified, you know, a minor medical issue that could be treated with medication, but from having all of those records. So actually that happened before the iPad announcement, but I got more excited about the tablet announcement. You know, I'd be excited about an Apple announcement anyway, just because I'm geeky that way. But it was amazing that it was like this. So, you know, obviously somebody's got a B2B business selling these into doctors' offices and other medical professionals. And, you know, that kind of built my excitement up about this, you know, about the potential of the, you know, of the tablet.
Yeah, the tablet's, I think, a significant move forward, because, you know, they've had tablets before. They've tried it. They've used a lot of pen technology. Now there's this touchscreen technology that's so good. And I think, yeah, obviously, this is just more portable devices that removes the keyboard, so you're much closer with the information. And you can see them becoming rather thin and very portable and even disposable on some level, that you'll have you just throw them out like they're magazines, essentially, or get them recycled or whatever they're going to do with them. But, no, I think that idea, the tablet, is profound, but I'm thinking about screens everywhere on tables. Information moves from each of these devices. You almost sweep it onto the next thing. Like, you see a book you like, and you sweep it into your tablet from a table.
Yeah.
And I think that's obviously coming eventually.
Yeah, when I worked in product, you know, you kind of did that between the screens at your desk, you know. So I can imagine doing that with product. I can imagine doing it with lots of different things, because we're doing it
in a work
application.
We'll be living in a Star Trek-esque world rather soon. We can right now. But, you know, I think in a really profound way, where, again, the thing that's most important is we've become the consumer. It becomes a consumer item rather than just a elite technology people item, which is important.
Interesting. Anything keep you up at night in terms of trends that you don't like so much? Yeah.
I love technology, so no. I mean, obviously, I'd be worried if governments, what's happening in China is appalling. That fascist government, you know, continues to defy with the trends towards transparency and openness. In a misguided attempt to try to control information, which is almost impossible. But, you know, that kind of stuff, I worry about once you get these abilities, what a bad government can do to any of them. And worry about people being left behind, you know, and children that aren't part of this, or parts of the world being in the dark in this area, and there's quite a few of them, not being able to access this massive amount of really wonderful information available to the whole world now. You know, libraries are wide open now, essentially, Wikipedia, all these things. And I'm sorry for the people that we can't get these prices down to areas where, you know, it would be great if, like, say a farmer in India in a rural area had as much crop information, rich crop information, information about planting, information about organic, you know, all kinds of things. The more information people have, the more good information they have. Go the other way, where information becomes controlled in a way that I don't think you can, but I would love to see these devices become so ubiquitous and cheap that we can do all kinds of things, like save on energy, save on, you know, there's a great opportunity here, I think, to energy, for example, the way we waste energy. I mean, conservation is our greatest ability to bring CO2 emissions to zero. You know, we don't have to even create new technologies, if we conserve and we use technology through power grid management and stuff like that, you know, even in your own house, knowing what to turn off is, you know,
yeah,
all that kind of stuff. I would hate to see it become all this frivolous, stupid, you know, oh, I'm at this bar, and that's what it turns into, is this stupid technology. You know, I'm in a bar and I'm going to check in. Like, who cares when you could, when you can take this technology and do profound things in healthcare and profound things in all kinds of ways. So that's what I think is important.
Well, Kev, our time is up, and I thank you so much for being on the show. I think you've grounded us in some really important realities, and I'll let you get on with your day.
Okay, thank you so much.
Thank you. We thank you. All right. our listeners, thank you as well.
Thanks a lot. Okay, bye-bye.
All right, bye-bye. So that was Kara Swisher from All Things D. You can catch her blog at Kara, K-A-R-A, at allthingsd.com. Or just check out allthingsd.com online for all the digital reporting or information on the digital information age that we live in today. Excellent, excellent reporting. Very high standard, you know, like you would expect from you know, someone who has a background from the Wall Street Journal and the Washington Post. So really glad to have had Kara on. In any event, I want to thank you, the listeners, for tuning into the A-List with me, Jennifer Lindsay. Remember to friend us or add us to your favorites here on Blog Talk Radio, if you would be so kind. And be sure to tune in next week when my featured guest is Charlene Lee. She is the founding partner of Altimeter Group and co-author of Groundswell. Catch that 1 week from today, starting at 12 noon Pacific. I think that's going to be a really fantastic time. Charlene is a very lovely person, and her new venture, the Altimeter Group, is actually inspired a phrase, Altimeter Envy. The Sage Circle blog just published something about that recently. So we'll ask her about that because having been lucky and having gone there and met with her staff, you know, everybody seems very happy to be there, which is always nice to see, especially in this economy. So anyway, we're very excited to be welcoming Charlene next week again at 12 noon Pacific, 1 week from today. As always, you can keep up with the latest on this show, archives, and more at Jennifer Lindsay, that's SAY.com. Have a great weekend.